This is the takeaway for Friday, November 3rd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillig. Thanks for being with us today. And let's start our Friday in Washington, where President Trump's pick to be the top scientist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture is out. Sam Clovis withdrew his nomination after being linked to Robert Mueller's ongoing Russia investigation. The former Iowa radio talk show host and Senate candidate wrote to the president yesterday. He said, "The political climate inside Washington has made it impossible for me to receive balanced and fair consideration for this position. The relentless assaults on you and your team seem to be a blood sport that only increase intensity each day." Now, that was all after it became clear that Sam Clovis was aware and may have helped guide George Papadopoulos' efforts to broker meetings between the Trump presidential campaign and the Russian government in the spring of 2016. Last month, you'll know that Papadopoulos pled guilty to lying to investigators about that, and he's now cooperating with Robert Mueller and his prosecutors. Sam Clovis was also the Trump campaign's co-chairman. He currently serves as USDA's senior White House advisor, and as of now, he's keeping that job. Now with more is Rebecca Ballhaus, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covering the White House and money in politics. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Here's Sam Clovis on CNN in June of 2016, stumping for Donald Trump.
The leadership of the Republican Party needs to figure out what they want. Either they want to get behind the presumptive nominee who will be the nominee of this party and make sure that we do everything we can to win in November, or we're just asking them, if they can't do that, then just shut the hell up.
But Rebecca, who is Sam Clovis, and how exactly did he end up nominated to be the chief science officer for the USDA?
So that goes back several years now, I would say. He has a background that doesn't quite fit that of a typical campaign policy advisor, particularly someone who would be advising on national security in the way that he was. His background, he worked in the Air Force for a while. He was a professor in Iowa. He taught business and public policy. And then he was a conservative radio talk show host, which is likely how Trump first became familiar with him. His political background consisted largely of he himself ran for Senate in 2013. He lost that Republican primary. And he also ran for state treasurer in Iowa. That was also successful. It's not totally clear how he ended up in the Trump campaign, aside from the fact that the campaign at that point, it was about January 2016, was pretty desperate for surrogates, and I think they were looking to take whoever they could get. Clovis had been working for Rick Perry's campaign, but Perry dropped out. Clovis, even while he was working for Perry, had often said that a lot of the people who supported him in his political ambitions were now Trump supporters. And I think that's likely something that drew Trump to him initially.
Well, Rebecca, you mentioned several things on Sam Clovis's resume: Senate candidate, radio talk show host, teacher, a couple of other things. Did any of those things qualify him to be the chief science officer at the Agriculture Department?
Well, that's the subject of a lot of criticism that he and the Trump administration have received since Trump nominated him to this post. And I think he himself hasn't argued that he has the kind of scientific background that nominees for that post typically have. He said he was qualified for it because to run for office in Iowa, as he did for Senate and for state treasurer, you need to have some knowledge of agriculture, and that was something that qualified him. He answered a questionnaire from a Democratic senator asking him, did you ever study these things? What scientific background did you have? And he didn't really try and argue that he did have any scientific knowledge or background, just that he had a basic knowledge of agriculture from his political experience.
So there are two stories now about Sam Clovis and why he may be out from this job. One, that he acknowledged to senators, as you said, that he has no background, really, in agriculture science. And the other, as I mentioned, is that he's closely connected to George Papadopoulos, the foreign policy advisor who pled guilty to lying to the FBI about trying to broker contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. What do we know about Clovis's relationship with George Papadopoulos and what may have happened in the campaign in the spring?
So what was revealed on Monday when this guilty plea by George Papadopoulos was unsealed was that a campaign supervisor, who we've since learned was Sam Clovis, was aware that George Papadopoulos was seeking to make these contacts with Russians, including brokering a meeting between representatives of the Trump campaign and representatives of Vladimir Putin, the Russian president. So Papadopoulos was informing his campaign supervisor, Clovis, that he was doing these things and was getting encouragement in return. At some point, Clovis said, "Great work." He said, "Run this through the campaign." At some point, it seems he was incrementally aware of what Papadopoulos was trying to do.
So what was the bigger liability then with senators who would have to confirm Sam Clovis for his science officer job? Was it the fact that he was probably unqualified or the fact that he was now tied to the Russia investigation?
My guess is that Clovis was most interested in avoiding the confirmation hearing he had scheduled for next week, where he certainly would have faced a large number of questions on the Russia issue. I think he already knew what he was getting himself into in terms of being nominated for the top scientist post without any scientific background. But I think he was probably eager to avoid, in a public setting, having to answer more questions. We know that he's already spoken to special counsel Bob Mueller's team, and has in fact testified before Mueller's grand jury. So he likely wasn't eager to keep talking about this, would be my guess.
And Rebecca, as you said, Clovis is apparently cooperating with investigators on Capitol Hill and in the Mueller investigation. Is he in any legal jeopardy himself?
So to be clear, no one has accused him of any wrongdoing so far. And we don't really know what's coming on that. I think that his involvement and what we've learned since about who else Papadopoulos may have informed about his efforts to establish contacts with Russians certainly could be a legal liability. I mean, these are people who are aware that a campaign aide was at some point trying to get stolen emails from Russia that they had taken from Democratic servers. So I think it's certainly a concern.
Rebecca Ballhaus with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks.
Here's a local media story now that's taking place all over the country. On Thursday, local news outlets DNA Info, Gothamist, and their sister sites in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, and D.C. abruptly closed their doors. Readers trying to visit the DNA Info homepage found the note from its founder, Joe Ricketts. It said DNA Info is, at the end of the day, a business. And businesses need to be economically successful if they are to endure. Ricketts is the billionaire founder of TD Ameritrade. The closure of the news organizations reportedly comes after employees there voted to unionize last week. Katie Honan was a reporter for DNA Info in Queens, New York, until yesterday. She was also on the organizing committee to unionize the employees there, and she's with me now in the studio. Katie, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
What kinds of stories were sites like DNA Info and Gothamist and DCist and Chicagoist doing?
You know, DNA Info and Gothamist and our, you know, sister sites, DNA Info Chicago and the other ists, as they're called, really focused on hyperlocal news. DNA Info was neighborhood focused. Each reporter had a bunch of neighborhoods that they covered. So anything that really happened in those neighborhoods, we covered. And the IST sites also covered New York City on a more broader level of reporting. So we really covered everything that would go on in these communities, a lot of times uncovered stuff that other people were not reporting.
So you guys voting to unionize seems to be a big issue here. I should disclose that some of our takeaway crew here at WNYC are in a union as well, including me. I'm in one. But let's start with that vote. Why did reporters at DNA Info unionize? Why was that important? And then what happened?
We decided to unionize with the Writers Guild of America East. It was something that our colleagues at Gothamist had in the works before this merger. And after it was announced, we met with our new colleagues. They discussed some of their issues, and we decided that it would probably be best if we joined together on this effort. We just wanted a seat at the table. I know that's what everyone says, but it is true. We didn't talk about any salary, any finances. We wanted to be able to sit down with management and speak with them about concerns, speak with them about ideas, speak with them about ways that we thought both sites could thrive together. And that's why we voted.
So you voted to unionize. That was last week. And then yesterday at work in the newsroom, what happened?
Well, most of DNA Info's reporters work remotely. So people found out from many different ways. I was at home and I went to see if a story of mine went up. And that's when I saw the letter. I have colleagues who were on the subway, who got phone calls from people asking them what was going on. In the newsroom, our editors who were there, they found out by looking at the homepage, our content management system, which for those who are not familiar, that's how we kind of get our stories up. It went down the same time. And then an email came soon after. But it all happened all at once. And for all of us, we didn't have any advance warning of it. It was something that Mr. Ricketts had threatened when we were unionizing. But it did happen very suddenly, exactly a week after we voted.
When you say the CMS, the website went down, that means if you go up on the website to find your stories, you'll find nothing there.
Right now, every URL on every DNA Info, New York, Chicago, and IST site redirects to the letter from our founder, Joe Ricketts.
And so what does that mean for the 180 or so employees who are now on the hunt for new jobs? Your stories, the record of your employment, the scoops you've had, they're not online anymore?
There is a hope that it'll come back. And I know spokespeople for the company have spoken to other media that they will eventually come back. But yeah, I mean, as it is now, the stories that I wrote 4 years ago, the stories that I wrote yesterday, I can't see them. And for a lot of my colleagues, as journalists, our calling card is our clips. And that is how we get new jobs. So right now, every story I've written over the past 4.5 years, I can't access.
Katie, what's the loss to local reporting here, do you think?
I think it's huge. Before I worked at DNA Info, I loved DNA Info. I read it every day. I was born and raised in Queens, so once they expanded to the other boroughs, it was very exciting to have people really devoted on a daily basis to writing about neighborhoods in Queens in a different way, in a deeper way, in a very thoughtful way. When I was hired at DNA Info, it was one of the best days of my life because I knew that I would be able to do that. And DNA Info gave me and my colleagues the opportunity to write about people and write about places that would not have gotten written about if we didn't do that. And I'm very thankful for that. And it is a loss to the many cities that now have lost these sites.
Well, we wish you the very best of luck and also the best of luck to all your colleagues who've lost their jobs since yesterday. So thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. And thank you always to our readers for reading us.
House Republicans unveiled their gigantic tax bill yesterday, calling it a once-in-a-generation chance to overhaul the code and cut taxes. Well, it's a bill that's really about one thing and one thing only: money. $1.5 trillion is the best guess right now. And that means that the people who want a piece of the action, they're mobilizing.
An army of lobbyists will come to protect the special interest provisions and to derail tax reform. And when that army comes, we must be able to count on the foot soldiers of the conservative movement to see this thing through.
That was House Speaker Paul Ryan back in October at the Heritage Foundation. An army of lobbyists is coming, he says. And that army and their clients are now busy pouring through the GOP tax bill to see if the loopholes they like are protected, or maybe even better, where they can punch out some new ones. It's a moment in Washington where one conversation can be worth billions of dollars. So, what's it like to be a tax lobbyist in Washington right now? Our next guest would know. Bob Schneider spent 2 decades as a lobbyist in areas ranging from foreign policy to national security and trade. He's currently a writer at Chicago Now. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bob, when you thumb through $1.5 trillion of tax cuts and tax overhaul from the Republicans, what do you see?
Well, I see a fantasy bill that the Republicans are putting forward. I heard yesterday from a trade association that are builders, and they said, did the president and the Republicans like the 2008 recession so much that they want to have another one? Because they're gutting entire industries in favor of tax cuts for major corporations.
Okay, well, let's take the builders, for instance. If the builders think that, I'm thinking that they might not like new caps on the mortgage interest deduction, right? Make it harder to get a tax break for paying your mortgage. So what happens when the Builders Association gets its lobbyists in a room and says, get up to Capitol Hill and get this thing changed?
Well, they head to Capitol Hill. And here's the problem that the lobbyists have. The chairman's markup of the bill is going to happen on Monday. Why Monday? Why is it are the Republicans trying to jam this through in a couple of weeks? Well, the reason is that Speaker Ryan is concerned about that army of lobbyists. And what those army of lobbyists are doing is they're heading up to Capitol Hill and they're sitting down and having frank discussions with people that they've supported in the past. Home builders and the construction and housing industry have poured millions and millions of dollars into Capitol Hill over the years. And they're sitting down, and there's a special dialogue that goes on inside the office when the door is closed. And one of them is you sit there and you look the guy in the eye and they say, look, this is a defining issue for us. And what those words mean is either you come around to our way of thinking or we're pouring the money that we've poured into you over the years into your opponent. And he will listen.
So, Bob, what you're suggesting is when that lobbyist gets with that member of Congress, they don't have to say, vote for this and we'll give you $50,000. No, they say, they basically imply, we've given you a lot of money for your election campaigns. You and I both know that. And if you don't do what we need, the spout turns off.
Well, even worse, the words, this is a defining issue, is lobbyist code talk for, we're going to support your opponent. In some respects, this bill is designed to do exactly that. As I got looking at this bill and I saw how many groups are under attack, and these are well-heeled groups, it almost seems like it's a shakedown bill. And shakedown bills are designed to be negotiated. Here's what the congressman will say. He'll say, look, I've got to go against my leadership on that. In this case, I'm going to need your help. I'm going to need your help means I want money. And there'll be a dance that goes on, and they'll come to a dollar amount. Now, I can give you an example, if you want, of how that dance will go. There's a rule in the House of Representatives that money may not be discussed on the Hill in a congressman or senator's office.
Right.
It is the most broken rule in the world. They will sit down and they will say, well, you know, your group has been good to us in the past. How much do you think a group like yours could raise for us? And lobbyists, knowing the rule, will say, oh, I don't know, somewhere between $30,000 and $35,000. And the congressman will say, maybe even as high as $40,000. And the lobbyists will say, that's doable or that's not doable. Whatever number you come up with, it's a deal.
Bob, there are loopholes all over the tax code. Look, we talked about the mortgage interest deduction and second homes, but there are lots of loopholes. We've seen loopholes for hybrid cars, different kinds of fuel that you can extract from paper mills and switchgrass, make it into ethanol, get a tax break for that. What's your favorite loophole in the tax code that just might have a lobbyist trying to keep it open this week?
Well, actually, there's one that's my absolute favorite, and that is the taxpayer-subsidized business jets.
Jets? Like private jets?
Yes, private jets.
Explain.
Well, if you take delivery on a private jet or any private aircraft, as long as it's new, brand new, between now and the start of 2019, the taxpayers will very graciously pay for that jets and its operation for 5 years through tax deductions. It's called bonus depreciation. And, you know, the business jet is a business asset as long as you use it 50% for business. Well, that gives you 50% of the time to use it for playing, too. I think that's awfully generous, don't you?
I think it's generous. Bob, you're the pro here. Play tax lobbyist and make your best case to the congressman that the bonus depreciation tax break on private jets just has to stay open.
I would go to, let's say, a congressman and a senator from the state of Kansas, where most of the business jets in the United States are manufactured. And I would say, hey, look, we employ 1 million workers in the United States. And by golly, we've got the Brazilians who have developed a very good business jet program, biting at our heels. We need to keep all of those people employed. And we think that the best way to do that is through extending bonus depreciation. And the congressman will take a look at, well, he'll hear the words 1 million jobs, and you have his interest. And of course, a little bit later on in the conversation will turn to, boy, what a tough re-election I've got. And, you know, I'm going to need some help. And then, you know, they'll say, well, at the appropriate time and in the appropriate way, we will help you. Deal's done. It's done. And, you know, the idea behind the deduction was not a bad one. In 2008, business jet sales went to nothing, nothing. And these companies were going to have to start laying off people if even stay in business. So the bonus depreciation was a temporary program to help during an economic crisis. Here's a rule in Washington. There's nothing more permanent than a temporary program.
Well, Bob, it's the kind of politics that in a way is maybe refreshing. Maybe it's so transactional and so cutthroat that it's easy to understand. You know, billions of dollars at stake in loopholes in exchange for re-election money. The kind of politics that people can wrap their heads around if they understand it. So I got to let you go, Bob. But when Paul Ryan says, like he said at the top, that conservative foot soldiers are going to have to defend against this army of lobbyists coming to Capitol Hill, what's going through the minds of Republican lawmakers?
Well, what's going through the minds of that one is that's a very direct threat. And they have a provision in that tax bill to stir up the evangelicals. And what they've done is they've taken down the barrier of the Johnson Amendment, which prohibits religious organizations from choosing political candidates. And in Republican politics these days, it used to be the corporations that drive things. Now it's the evangelicals. And when he talks about that army, he's talking about unleashing that army. And that's not an army that especially Southern state members of Congress who are big on deficit reduction. Speaker Ryan has threatened his own people with that statement.
The Republican tax cut bill is out, $1.5 trillion worth. The loopholes are at stake. The lobbyists are mobilized. And the threats have been issued. Bob Schneider with Chicago Now. Bob, what a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
41 detainees are currently held at the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. Just two of those are death penalty cases being tried at the camp. And one of them, the case of Abdulrahim al-Nashri, is in the headlines this week. Nashri is on trial for his involvement in the 2000 USS Cole bombing off the coast of Yemen that killed 17 sailors. Carol Rosenberg is a reporter for the Miami Herald and the only reporter at Guantanamo Bay. She reminds us, who is Abdulrahim al-Nashri?
He's a Saudi man. He's been in U.S. custody since 2002, was held by the CIA and brought to Guantanamo in 2006. And he is accused of being basically Osama bin Laden's operator on attacks in the Arabian Sea before and after the 9/11 attacks.
Now, it's not the circumstances around Nashri that are generating controversy. Instead, questions about the rules of the military court and attorney-client privilege mean that Nashri's defense lawyers have refused to comply with judges' orders to participate in this trial remotely via teleconference from a war court in Virginia. Carol Rosenberg says it's unprecedented. It leaves Nashri on trial today for his life with no death penalty defender at his side.
Because Nashri is charged in a death penalty case, he's entitled to a death penalty defense attorney, a capital defender. The law says he must have an experienced capital defender. And there aren't that many in the military. So the Pentagon has pretty systematically hired people like Rick Kamen, the death penalty defender for Nashri, outside and paid them what's currently $185 an hour rate to defend these men at the military tribunals. Rick Kamen has come here for pretty much a decade to litigate and meet with Nashri and to, you know, go to court and represent him. He has two colleagues he had brought on board, also civilians, also paid by the Pentagon, and they have systematically come down to every hearing. This time, they are not here because they argue they quit the case. They argue that they are no longer his lawyers and that they quit the case in mid-October for reasons we really aren't allowed to know. You know, Nashri was held by the CIA for years. He's held in a secret prison at Guantanamo for years. Many aspects of this case, because of where he was held and what the CIA did to him and with him, are classified. His circumstances of detention here are classified. And now the defense attorneys say they've discovered something classified that has made it ethically impossible for them to defend him because they say this secret thing has violated attorney-client privilege. essentially reading between the lines, they aren't having private conversations with their client. If you read between the lines, they believe somebody is listening in or wiretapping, and that they believe that it is a non-starter, that if you can't have the privilege, if you can't meet with your client privately without intrusion of the government, you ethically cannot defend them.
So, Carol, Nashri's own defense team doesn't want to participate anymore. Meanwhile, the military has a supervisor for this entire defense team, Marine Brigadier General John Baker. How does he figure into this story?
General Baker is the overall attorney overseeing every defense team involved in Guantanamo cases. He doesn't represent any single detainee. He gets resources for defense teams. He also decides who to assign to cases, and he believes he has the authority to excuse people from cases. And this is the issue. When these three lawyers came to him and said, "We believe we have an ethical obligation to quit," they got an ethics opinion, and they presented him with documents and an argument, both classified and unclassified, and said, "We need to resign." General Baker reads the law that this is entirely his authority to decide, and he approved the resignations of these three civilian lawyers. And to understand how important that is, once you lose the death penalty defender, the learned counsel, this man Rick Kamen, by law, you're not supposed to go forward with the case. So when General Baker decided to let those three lawyers go, he immediately set out, he tells me, to find another death penalty defender to see if he or she would consider himself to have the same ethical issues. He figures in because the judge in the case says, "You, General Baker, do not decide which attorneys of record leave the case. Only I, the judge, have that authority." And frankly, if it weren't the war court, I think that's pretty much would be the rule in any other court, that you have to appear before a judge in order to get excused. General Baker says he reads the rules. He's been a Marine officer for 28 years. He's been a prosecutor. He's been a defense attorney. He's studied the rules, and he believes that either intentionally or not, Congress vested in the chief defense counsel the authority to release lawyers.
Well, General John Baker has had some conflicts with the judge, Colonel Vince Spath. Where's General Baker now?
So Air Force Colonel Vance Spath, the judge, called Baker in front of him, the general, and said, "You do not have that authority. You must take back your decision excusing them. Only I can decide, and bring those three lawyers down to Guantanamo Bay." General Baker refused. "We are down here for a hearing without the three lawyers and in court, and General Baker refused to testify about his authority. He refused to testify about the ethical issue, and he refused a direct order from the judge to basically withdraw his excusal, put him back on the case. So in something I have never seen at the war court, something that has never happened in military commissions, the judge, an Air Force colonel, found the general, the chief defense counsel, guilty of contempt and sentenced him to 21 days confinement and to pay a $1,000 fine. Now, this is Guantanamo. You'd think there's lots of empty cells here, but he did not send him to the terror prison. He did not send him to the empty cells where Nashri and the other 40 detainees are kept. He ordered him to his quarters for 21 days. And only at Guantanamo would that be a trailer park right behind the war court in an area called Camp Justice. The general is confined to his trailer, can't leave, and is under detention.
What does all this mean for the defendant? What does all this mean for Nashri?
You know, this week, with all the back and forth over defense attorneys, whether they show up, whether they boycott, with the general in confinement, this is less about Nashri being on trial than the system, the military commission set up after 9/11, being on trial. They created this court during the Bush administration, and this is a fundamental question that is being answered how many years later.
Carol Rosenberg in Guantanamo Bay following the complicated, twisted, and ongoing trial of accused USS Cole bombing mastermind Abdalrahim al-Nashri. Carol Rosenberg of the Miami Herald, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
For the past few weeks here on The Takeaway, we've been looking 50 years into the future, bringing you little visions of the year 2067 from across the world of science fiction. Today, we hear from Alaya Don Johnson. She's a speculative fiction author based in Mexico City. Alaya thinks a lot about massive wealth inequality in the world today. In 50 years, she says, this could go one of two ways. Wealthy nations get even richer, or the exploited peoples of the world use technology to band together and fight back.
You know, it's not new, but it's something that I think technology and the internet and certain social forces have made much stronger and powerful force recently, which is social justice movements and movements for increased autonomy of marginalized groups. That is something that I think that connectivity can begin to combat. And I can see how that might be enough in the context of other sort of global changes, because of course the reason that that sort of increased concentration of wealth has been able to take place is because of resource exploitation, privatization, is because of economic and environmental factors that aren't sustainable. And so at some point, something is going to have to break. So when it does, will that rupture be enough of a space for a different vision of how we can live to take hold and for that to be our future? Right now, I live in Mexico City, and Mexico has recently had one of the most successful indigenous movements of modern times with the Zapatistas, or the EZLN, which has very explicitly advocated for autonomy. Of course, the other side of this is that the Mexican government has cracked down on the EZLN, and that state violence in service of capitalist interests is very much something that, you know, in this hopeful vision of the future, I'm imagining is something that will be a inevitable reality. And that violence absolutely works to repress and to silence these movements. So when I'm imagining kind of what the future might look like, I mean, I can see it reaching a level of, you know, war. I definitely think we are headed to some kind of a tipping point. I think there's just too many stressors and too much conflict, and more than conflict, too much resource exploitation. I mean, it is literally impossible to continue in the direction that we're going without some kind of correction. A future that we want to live in must be a more open, multicultural, as I say, but plural future. I think that if we're going to get out of this, you know, if our future really will be something better than our present, and it won't kind of fall into these holes that I, and I think a lot of other people, see as real dangers in the future, I think that it will be necessary to not look for one person, but to imagine many, many, many people with different voices and different ideas being able to exist in the same space.
That was speculative fiction writer Alaya Don Johnson. Her most recent book is called Love is the Drug. You can check out the whole 2067 series on our website at thetakeaway.org/2067.
Really did it.
You maniac! You blew it up!
This is stone blowing up.
Toss it before it reaches the core. You have to anchor it.
Money's safe. We're not. The water rose a foot in the last 20 minutes.
Fog is getting thicker.
And Leon's getting larger.
It's Friday, time to talk movies for the weekend here on The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman is here, film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Rafer, good to have you back.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Great. Great to see you. And I'm excited about a couple of the movies that you have for us this weekend. We're going to talk about Thor Ragnarok, the brand new Thor movie. The Hulk's in that and a lot of other people, too. I'm going to see that one. I am definitely going to see LBJ this weekend with Woody Harrelson. I don't care what you say about it. I'm going to see it. But we're going to talk about that first. I've got a little bit of LBJ trivia for you, if you don't mind. Now, hold on to your answers, folks. You can hit me on Twitter if you think you know it. Rafer cannot if he thinks he knows this one. Woody Harrelson is starring as LBJ in the new Rob Reiner film. We're going to talk about that. Here are a couple of LBJs from the screen over the recent years. See if you can name these two actors.
Those big Eastern power companies that string their wires across our land ain't never going to give us nothing.
The Dixiecrats are going to fight me tooth and nail on this civil rights stuff.
Two different LBJs for you. Can you name both of them? Can you name one of them? Mm. Get a half a point. Let's see. Hit me on Twitter if you know. Rafer, LBJ from Rob Reiner. This is Woody Harrelson, Jennifer Jason Leigh as Lady Bird, right?
That's right.
Let's get a clip.
She is family.
I don't know how I miss the resemblance. Look, what I'm talking about here is freedom. There's nothing wrong with that.
Then why are we whispering?
That's LBJ and I think Senator Richard Russell, the segregationist from Georgia, talking there.
That's right. Played by Richard Jenkins. This is the story, basically one small slice of the LBJ story here, which is really just his attempts to pass the Civil Rights Act. So that's, you know, we're not talking about Vietnam. We're not talking about Medicare, Medicaid, any of that stuff.
Right.
Just this one little slice. And that's pretty interesting. You know, the caller you just had on the show talking about the tax bill and sort of horse trading. There's a lot of that in here, you particularly between Senator Russell and LBJ as he's trying to get this guy to kind of move closer and closer to allowing this bill to pass. And there is something about this film, I guess because there was so much going on with the Johnson presidency, that felt a little incomplete to me. I know they had a very narrow mandate here, and in some ways I like that, but at the same time, I just never felt like I quite got the full picture of Lyndon Johnson's term and him as a man.
Well, those of us who consume all things LBJ will probably go. Now, whether it fits into the broader canon, I guess we'll have to see. How about Woody Harrelson,
like
though?
Woody Harrelson, very good. A lot of fun. I think he brings a lot of life to a president that I think we mostly think of as kind of a serious, somewhat dour guy.
Let's talk about the LBJ of the superhero world, who is Thor.
You must be Hela. I'm Thor, son of Odin.
Really? Neil.
Beg your pardon.
Neil.
And nobody plays the evil queen princess like Cate Blanchett.
That's right. And very nicely named Hela in that in that movie. Thor, the Thor franchise, I've always felt was kind of the weaker one of the Marvel things. Was it supposed to be funny? Was it supposed to be serious? This one is a lot of fun. Much more Guardians of the Galaxy than, say, a Dark Knight or a Batman kind of thing. Lot of fun. Taika Waititi, the New Zealand director, part of Flight of the Conchords, is at the helm. Does a great job. This is the first Thor, I would say, that I really enjoyed.
And it's been well reviewed too. All right, let's get to trivia before we let you go, Rafer. I played you a couple of LBJs at the top, and I wanted you to see if you can name them.
Those big Eastern power companies that string their wires across our land ain't never gonna give us nothing.
The Dixiecrats are gonna fight me tooth and nail on this civil rights stuff.
Rafer?
I'm drawing a total blank, Todd.
The first one was Randy Quaid in LBJ, the early years, 1987 on NBC. And the second one you got to get, that's Bryan Cranston in All the Way on HBO, 2016.
You got me, as usual.
Rafer Guzman, film critic, Newsday, and for us. Thanks, Rafer.
Thanks, Todd.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this weekend, artist Patti Smith will sing that song, People Have the Power, in a concert in Carnegie Hall.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, of an aspect bright and fair.
Now, you might not expect Carnegie Hall to host an artist like Patti Smith, or for a punk legend like Patti Smith to want to play Carnegie Hall, but Patti Smith is on a mission. The Trump administration backed away from the Paris Climate Agreement back in June, but many cities across the country have been trying to meet carbon emissions targets on their own, and that's where Patti Smith and her daughter, Jessie Paris Smith, come in. Jesse co-founded the group Pathways to Paris, advocating for climate change policies around the world. Patty and Jesse are now behind what they call the Thousand Cities Initiative. And they joined me here in the studio ahead of this week's concert at Carnegie Hall to talk about why the time is now to address climate change.
As I travel, I mean, just to take it on a simple personal level, I've seen the changes in our environment from city to city all over the world, such an escalation of cars, more use of fossil fuels and gas, and everywhere I go, sometimes it's so polluted out that, you know, it's hard to even take a nice walk in a city. And we see all of the escalation since I was a young girl of natural disasters, which would be one in every 10 years or one in every 20 years. And now it's a domino effect of natural disasters. So the time is really, it's now to do what we can to put a halt on the devastation of our environment.
Jesse, you're co-founder of the Thousand Cities Initiative, which I mentioned, getting commitments from 1,000 cities, as it were, to take action on climate change. I suppose the point of this is, in the absence of what you see as substantial climate policy coming from Washington or from other governments.
Well, we founded Pathway to Paris in 2014. We originally founded it to push for the world to come up with a legally binding global climate agreement. And we did this through concerts and uniting musicians and activists and politicians just to amplify the message. And when the Paris Agreement was reached, we changed our movement to be about turning the Paris Agreement into reality. But pretty much when Trump was elected, we decided, okay, let's not just have these events and these dialogues for raising awareness. Let's also offer a tangible solution. So we came up with this idea of the Thousand Cities Initiative, which is without the need of federal government. And it's the idea of if 1,000 cities around the world commit to going 100% renewable energy by 2040, then we can meet the requirements of the agreements. You know, when Trump announced that the U.S. was pulling out of the Paris Agreement, you saw cities all over the country standing up and saying, we're not backing off of the Paris Agreement. We're still going to continue with our plans and meet the requirements. So part of the focus of the Thousand Cities Initiative is also to highlight what cities are already doing, but it's also to engage citizens. So the petition that we launched is really a citizen action tool to get regular people to push for their city. So that's what we're really focused on now. And then hopefully there'll be just all the cities of the world will join on.
Patty Smith, why are we here in this moment when it comes to climate change? There are a lot of aspects to President Trump's candidacy, as we all know. One of them wasn't just skepticism or reluctance on climate change. It was saying this is a hoax. This is a hoax invented by the Chinese. And for all of the other attributes of this campaign, a lot of Americans either didn't mind that message or responded positively to it.
I think the reason that citizens react in this way is because these kind of initiatives require sacrifice. When Jimmy Carter was president and we had the oil crisis, he asked the American people to carpool, to put their thermostat down to 68, to find a way to conserve energy, not to use so much gas. And a lot of the population felt very affronted. They felt that—
People laughed at him.
Well, they laughed at him, were angry at him, and didn't reelect him. And part of it is they don't want to sacrifice. But we have to find language or some way to communicate to people that in sacrificing to meet these measures, they are giving a gift to their children and their grandchildren. And we need people to start looking into the future. And actually, the future is coming right at us.
Patty Smith, is your art better in angry times or hopeful times? I hear both from you right now. You say you're hopeful and energized by what your daughter's doing, and I get that. You're also angry, I think, about what's going on in the world. And you're an artist. Everybody knows that. When is your art better?
Well, as a private artist, I mean, when I'm writing poetry or drawing or taking photographs, I don't require any specific climate. It's a very internalized kind of work. But as a performer, having something to react against is very energizing, and it's, for me, a very energizing time. I feel like I have a lot to speak about, to bring my energy to help ignite or inspire people to action. And so as a performer, this kind of climate is very useful.
Jesse, some of this activism is personal for your mom. Is it personal for you?
Of course. I hope that climate change is a personal issue for everyone. I know it's not, but I think everyone who is part of the movement realizes that, you know, the earth is our shared home, and this is the most critical issue of our time. It's an issue that affects every single person, living being, animal life, plant life. It affects everything.
Patti Smith, you talked about this being personal for people and all the different disasters that we've seen over the last 10 years, if you want to pick that number. People who don't live in New York might not know that you have a house in a beach area of New York City called the Rockaways, which barely skated through Sandy, right?
Well, my little house, I had a little bungalow, which I bought 3 weeks before Hurricane Sandy, had no insurance, and it was semi-destroyed. It took 2 years to make it livable and to get any kind of gas and electricity to redo the plumbing. But of course, it was my little writer house, so what happened to me wasn't as important as to what happened to my neighbors. But there were people who went nearly a year without electricity, without proper heat. And so many of us, Jesse included, many of our friends went and helped people clean out their basements. And there were mountains of people's washing machines and their couches and everything destroyed and cars. But what was to me even, of course, much more heartbreaking was how nature destroys itself. And we lost our dunes. We lost, you know, all of the plant life that protects the dunes. It's heartbreaking that if we, in our misuse of nature, that nature turns in not on us, because nature has no mind or no animosity, but she does turn in on herself. She destroys herself. One looks at these things and they keep happening over and over again. And I just wonder how much has to happen till people wake up.
Patti, I have a tough question for you, given your criticism of President Trump. In the summer of last year, in June of 2016, you advocated pretty strongly and performed on behalf of Julian Assange and his release and on behalf of WikiLeaks. Events followed that, and it's pretty clear now that WikiLeaks had a role in helping Russian interference in the election and may have had a role in helping get Donald Trump elected. And given your views of Donald Trump, I wonder if the opportunity to advocate on behalf of WikiLeaks or for Julian Assange came up again, if you would do it the same way.
Probably not. I actually admire Julian. I've met him several times. He's quite intelligent, and he's got a global fix on the world that is really incredible. He's an incredibly intelligent man. But in view of as the things you spoke of, I have backed away. That doesn't mean I'm recanting, because I still, I liked him very much, and I believe in freedom of the press. But I don't believe in, like in Star Trek, as they say, I don't believe in throwing a wrench in the prime directive. But there are a lot of things that I found, for even though I'm a registered Democrat, what the DNC did to Bernie Sanders, I thought, made me step away. A lot of the things that the Democratic Party has done has made me step away from and really examine the Democratic Party. I'll step away and reexamine anything because new information is important. It's important to be constantly educated. So right now, the way I feel is, when I look at everything, that we need a new party.
But you know, but Patti, you don't feel some sense of betrayal having put your reputation and your art and your advocacy on the line for Julian Assange, that he probably helped elect somebody who you consider, through what you're saying here today, Donald Trump, the president, somebody extremely detrimental to the other things that are important to you?
Well, first of all, the word is probably. I have, when he goes, if he goes on trial and certain things come out, but, things are so complex. I feel more betrayed by the fact that in the last election, probably only 50% of the people voted. So, Trump was really you know, he was nominated by maybe 24% of the people in America. That's how I feel betrayed. People ask me, well, didn't you feel working for Ralph Nader, you know, through the kink in the machine of that election? No, I don't. I feel what threw a kink in the machine in that election was also the fact that half of our citizens didn't vote. So the re-examination of Julian Assange is, you know, for me, that's a personal matter. I like him as a human being. If he did that, and I've been thinking a lot about that, I haven't visited him or spoken to him. And if I decided that I would ask him outright because, you know, I have a relationship that I could ask him that. But it, I don't feel like that is the major factor in why the election went the way it did. I think the election went the way it did because half of the country didn't vote.
Artist Patti Smith, what an honor to have you here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And Jesse Paris Smith, musician and activist, co-founder of Pathway to Paris, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you very much.
Patti Smith will perform at the Pathway to Paris Climate Action Concert in partnership with the United Nations and 350.org this Sunday at Carnegie Hall here in New York. That's it for us. Thank you so much for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.